for 3 days after the accident about the oxidizer or its harmful effects. The reports were part of a cover-up, Kennedy thought. The Air Force cared more about preserving the image of the Titan II missile than protecting the lives of its own men. The Accident Investigation Board said that Kennedy and Livingston were never ordered to turn on the fan in the launch complex. "Do not operate the switch," Sergeant Michael Hansen told them over the radio, according to the accident report. "Just go to the switch and stand by." Kennedy thought the report was wrong. He and Livingston had both heard the order to turn on the fan. Livingston had signaled that he'd go back down and do it. That was one of Kennedy's last memories before the explosion. Turning on the fan wasn't part of their original checklist. It was Hansen's idea. Hansen had suggested it earlier in the evening, while Kennedy and others were arguing that all the electricity should be shut off. And Kennedy had absolutely no doubt that a spark from the fan had caused the explosion. But now Hansen was saying that an order to turn on the fan had never been given, and Colonel Morris was backing Hansen, making the source of ignition seem like some great big mystery. "You didn't need to be a rocket scientist," Kennedy thought, "to figure out why the missile exploded." Livingston obeyed the order, turned on the fan, and seconds later the whole place blew up. And the man who was killed by the error was now being blamed for it. Livingston's death deeply affected Kennedy. They were close friends, and his death seemed completely unnecessary. Kennedy thought that his commanders at SAC had made a series of mistakes. The decision to evacuate the control center, the refusal to open the silo door and vent the fuel vapor, the endless wait to re-enter the complex, the insistence upon using the access portal instead of the escape hatch, the order to turn on the fan. Worst of all was the feeling that he and Livingston had risked their lives for nothing and then been abandoned. Livingston had lain on the ground for more than an hour without his helmet, inhaling oxidizer before anyone came to help. And the delay in sending a helicopter was incomprehensible. The morale among the PTS crews at Little Rock Air Force Base was terrible. Airman David Powell, who'd dropped the socket that hit the missile, blamed himself for Livingston's death. A number of PTS technicians refused to work on Titan II missiles, citing the danger of the job, and their security clearances were revoked. Drug and alcohol use increased. The commander of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, Colonel John Moser, was abruptly reassigned to a desk job at Fort Ritchie in Maryland, overseeing the monthly replacement of computer tapes for the PSYOP. A career-ending move. Moser was well-liked, and he hadn't made the crucial decisions that led to the explosion. Nobody at SAC headquarters was fired. Many of the enlisted men in the 308th thought the Air Force was scapegoating the little guys in order to hide problems with the Titan II and protect the top brass. A few weeks after the Accident Investigation Board's report was made public, Jeff Kennedy was served with a formal letter of reprimand by the Air Force. It rebuked him for violating the two-man rule and entering the control center at 4-7 without permission. No mention was made of the valuable information he'd obtained there or the bravery he'd displayed trying to save the missile. Air Force regulations permitted a violation of the two-man rule during an emergency if lives were at risk. But Kennedy wasn't granted an exemption from the rule. His punishment sent a clear message. The rowdy, hell-raising culture of the PTS crews would no longer be tolerated. They were held responsible for what had gone wrong, not aging equipment or the decisions made at SAC headquarters. And to enforce strict discipline, an officer now accompanied a PTS crew everywhere like a babysitter, whenever it visited a missile site. David Powell was given an Article 15 citation, dereliction of duty, for attaching the socket to the wrong tool. Powell thought that if he accepted the charge, he'd be admitting negligence and assuming responsibility for the accident. Powell refused to sign and faced the risk of a court-martial instead, where he could defend himself before a panel of military judges. The Air Force didn't seek a court-martial and gave him a lesser punishment. Jeff Kennedy had planned to spend the rest of his career in the Strategic Air Command. Now he desperately wanted to leave it. Kennedy applied for a medical discharge, hoping to return home and attend college in Maine. The Air Force balked at the request, despite his injuries. Kennedy was sent to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, for a medical evaluation. He was placed in the psychiatric ward there, along with Greg Devlin, who was also pursuing a medical disability claim. Devlin had torn his Achilles tendon, suffered burns on his face, neck, back, and hands. He spent 10 days at a Little Rock hospital recovering from the skin grafts. But the Air Force was not pleased with Devlin. He'd spoken to reporters about the accident without SAC's permission. And he'd filed a $1.5 million lawsuit against the manufacturer of the Titan II, Martin Marietta. Members of the armed forces cannot sue the federal government for damages after an injury. David Livingston's family and Rex Huckle had also decided to sue Martin Marietta. One of the attorneys suing the defense contractor, Bill Carter, was an Air Force veteran and a former Secret Service agent who hoped to obtain compensation for his clients and to establish in court that the Titan II missile system was unsafe. Carter owned a farm near Damascus and had represented a neighbor sickened by the oxidizer leak there in 1978. During that case, the Surgeon General of the Air Force had denied that inhaling oxidizer was bad for you, claiming it was a substance no more dangerous than smog. Devlin could not believe that he and Kennedy had been confined in a mental ward after everything they'd been through. The place was full of crazy people, like a scene from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Devlin already felt shunned by the Air Force. After returning to duty, he'd been put to work selling hot dogs at the base, a job usually reserved for airmen caught with illegal drugs or facing a dishonorable discharge. But selling hot dogs was preferable to staying in a loony bin. Kennedy would have none of it. He told the staff to release them immediately and move them to a different wing at the hospital, or he'd contact the press. They were promptly transferred. After being examined by physicians, Kennedy was denied a medical discharge, and Devlin was denied a full medical disability. It would have allowed him to use Air Force hospitals for the rest of his life. A few months later,